webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 4th of September 2014, coming to you from the GR Studios right here in Nashville, Tennessee, where we say with Winston Churchill, everybody meets with the truth during their lifetimes, but most people get up and dust themselves off and keep going as though nothing had happened. And here from Houston, Texas, once again, the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution is Mr. Michael Williams. G'day, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, Ferris. It's always a delight. I look forward to the morning of our show, goodness gracious. And I told you, I'm the first listener each time. And I did again this last week. And oh my gosh, if you missed last week's show, let me tell you, as a participant and a listener, you missed the world. This was the one where everything came together. It's funny that your quote from Winston Churchill kind of ties in with where we were last week and the question about why do you understand this truth and why do you think you got it? And I think Winston Churchill was correct, and that's kind of what we said also. It was that everybody has had this chance, and I just didn't have sense enough to get up and dust myself off and go on.
Gospel Revolution. We are one.
Oh boy, mate, we have got such a bundle of news today. We have.
We do.
Let's start with Moses Gata in Nakuru, Kenya.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about it. Last week we were talking about his migraine headaches. This week a whole lot more has happened.
Last week was my first time to even mention this, that's been going on for the better part of this past year. And I got an email from, it was actually from Moses, and he was telling me that his situation had been diagnosed, and that instead of migraines, he had a brain tumor. His email said that he had to have surgery and that he was going into the hospital immediately. And when I got an email from Elizabeth, she said that Moses has been having to rely on her more and more to be able to translate for this because of the extreme pain and difficulty he's had. But she told me that they were working on translating this for the radio stations.
Translating what?
Translating the messages into Swahili for the Catholic radio station and also for the Muslim radio station, because this is the predominant language there in that area of the world. As it turns out, she's been having to help him do everything because of his diminished capacity. And he blacked out while they were doing this. That's when I got the email from him, was after he came to, and the hospital was the next thing on the agenda. Moses had emergency surgery, only at the mercy of someone. Actually, it was his brother's employer that fronted $5,000, I think it was. The entire surgery was to cost about $11,000. He wants payment back in at the end of October, but Moses is recovering well. He went into a coma the day after his surgery, but did recover from that, did come back out of the coma. And I forwarded the brain scans and everything to one of our dear friends who is a doctor. And he assured me that the surgery was most likely going to be successful because of the location of the tumor. And so we faxed all those things up, forwarded all of those scans up, and we got those from Moses. And goodness gracious, it's been just terribly difficult for the Gata family. We've looked everywhere to find funds to be able to send to them. We just don't have funds. It's been heartbreaking for me to know that the people that we depend on the most, goodness, we can't do anything for them. Jeff posted on Facebook. I told him to go ahead and at least inform people as to what was going on, and he did. And we send funds to Kenya through PayPal. With all of the difficulty that we have found in getting funds there and how to do it, PayPal seems to be the best way to do it. Barris, we only had three or four people that were able to respond to Moses' need there in Kenya. But there's one that I want to mention in particular. And
what do you mean? You mean we have favorites?
Well, in this case, it's not necessarily a favorite, although Judy's been a friend for many years to me and to the Gospel Revolution. Judy Tanini, who has been a single mom for many years now, single grandmother also, and her father and mother are both ill, and her father in critical condition. Now, I know Judy, and I know that she works very hard. And when I noticed that she had posted $500 into the PayPal account to be dispersed out to Moses, which that's that's already been sent. But here's the thing, Barris. She posted this in four different posts.
What, all on the same day?
All on the same day, but four different ones.
That can only mean one thing.
She's fishing through her accounts, trying to see where she's got a spare 100 here, 150 there, to be able to send. Or she had done it all in one, you know. Judy really stepped up for Moses. But that's the update on Moses. And I know that all of you guys know the value of what Moses has done. Now here's the next dilemma this sweet family is in. The gentleman who fronted the money, which they, these private hospitals, the reason he didn't go to a public hospital, right in the middle of this emergency, all of the public hospitals are on strike. The doctors are on strike. So there's nobody's getting help and nobody's getting surgeries through the public hospital. Besides that, he would have had to wait a long time to get in for surgery there. So this was a private hospital that he went to, and they require approximately half up front. And this gentleman, as I said, he's requiring this payment back in October. But here's the other horrible catch in this story. And I promise we'll get to stuff that's going to make you feel good. I promise. Moses, as to my last communication with them, is there in the hospital, supposed to be able to be leaving there after this successful surgery. They've sent me photos and everything of him there in the hospital. But for him to get out in Kenya, you have to have your bill paid before you leave. So
your money, the body or the money?
One of the two. You're held hostage in the hospital until the bill is paid. So the bill keeps going up because even if they're not doing anything for you, you're occupying a bed. So, oh, goodness.
Oh, my God.
We complain about the way things are around here, but goodness, there's times when the reality of just how bad it is in other places in the world and the burden that it puts upon people, not that there's not burdens put on people here, but goodness gracious, who would even think of being held hostage in a hospital until payment was made? I don't know what the end game of that is. My last email to Elizabeth was to find out what the end game is. I asked her what's going to happen when the gentleman who's demanding his money be paid back by the end of October, what is his recourse. What is he going to do? I don't know if they can take your home, if they can take your possessions, or what they can do if you have a debt like that. I just don't know what it is like. And the other thing is, what is the hospital going to do when there aren't funds there to release him? Now, the hospital's been paid the $5,000 up front to get Moses out of the hospital. I'm embarrassed to tell you how little the amount is by comparison to anything. You talk about brain surgery, you're talking $150,000 here just for a nice few days stay at the hospital, not counting all the other things. But to get Moses out of the hospital, it's only $6,000, Ferris. And
I'm gobsmacked. I don't even know what to say. I'm just sitting here with my mouth hanging open. You could sail a yacht through my mouth right at the moment. I should have. I mean, we know that there are places in the world that are like this, but to hear this story so close to home is it's giving me a little bit of an ache that I don't want.
It is indeed, and I know everybody who's listening has the very same reaction to it. And you guys, it's always so encouraging to them just to get an email from you. And so if you would like to send them an email, they stopped being able to get things through the physical mail because somewhere along the route they discovered that we were actually tucking in a $100 bill here or there. And it's a difficult part of the world. Terrorism is – this is one of the main areas where terrorism is – Moses Moses is putting his life on the line by translating and broadcasting on a Muslim radio station. I don't have words. I am at a loss as to what to say or what to do.
Find your guiding inspiration in a place where dreams are made with a lifetime's preparation. It's no time to be afraid. Put our differences behind us while we shine like the sun. See what we've all become together.
Michael, this week we got an email from Name Withheld, and he says the subject is Paul and Sin. And he says, "Hi, Mike, I love your teaching. Can't say that I'm on the same page with all you teach, but I'm journeying and loving freedom." I agree that sin was eradicated at the cross, but why does Paul speak so strongly? You know, that just reminded me what he said. I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt this. What he said just reminded me of something that a buddy of mine, well, actually he's not a friend of mine, he's a Facebook friend, if you like, Jack Stradwick from Auckland, New Zealand, said this just this morning on Facebook. He said, "Did you ever pull on a loose thread on your mum's knitted jumper only to find the whole thing unravelling in your hands? And boy, were you in trouble. It's kind of like that when you start pulling on the loose ends of your belief system. Before you know, the neatly constructed thing you sheltered behind is in pieces. And boy, are you in trouble. So what do we do? Do we try to patch it up and pretend it never happened and that there are no holes in my truth? Or do we keep pulling on those dodgy bits and see what happens? Do you understand that phrase, dodgy bits?"
Yes, I think everyone will. In other words, we get up and dust ourselves off and pretend nothing happened.
I didn't know if dodgy bits was an Aussie kind of an expression.
It is, but I think that we can translate. Yes.
Oh man, you translate on the fly. I love it. Surely truth can bear inspection and dissection, and if it can't, why is it called truth? But be ready for the fallout from those who knitted it for you and expected you to wear it forever. Yeah, When this friend of ours said, I love your teaching, can't say that I'm on the same page with all you teach, but I'm journeying and loving freedom. It just reminded me of that. Question. I agree that sin was eradicated at the cross, but why does Paul speak so strongly about sin in so many places? Why does he say in Colossians 3:6 that if we do certain things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience? Pretty strong words, especially since the wrath of God ended at the cross. Thank you. And then he signs off.
Yes, this is a very standard question that we've gotten over the years about this particular thing, about how does the man who taught us that sin is done away with at the cross then say so much about sin and its effect and its consequences? Well, that's where it is vitally important to read in context Paul's conditions, not only in Corinthians, but also Galatians. There's lists, the famous list as to who, if they commit these certain sins, are not going to make it into the kingdom of God. But what you have to understand is that Paul was a teacher of the law before he was a teacher of the gospel. So he is going to, and does on many occasions, make sure that we understand the consequences of the way it was. This is the consequences of sin. And he always makes sure that we don't get to build fence laws and subdivide the law down and boil it down to things to where we can excuse ourselves and condemn others. He really was in lockstep with Jesus about sin. It's not just if you did it, it's if you even think it. So Paul's lists are very severe. And he makes sure that he adds those sins that all of society condemns, plus those that all of society participates in, such as gossip, such as murmuring, such as complaining, such as and the list goes on. But when you see Paul going through this demonstration of how severe the consequences of sin are, he is doing it for the backdrop of saying how important it was that sin has been done away with. And you're right, the writer is absolutely correct. It would be nonsensical that all of the teaching that we get out of the New Testament about the eradication of sin at the cross, that the very same man would write to us about the consequences of sin in daily life today. It just makes no sense. So these lists are important. When I read them like I read the law, because that's what Paul is teaching when he does this. And I read them to say, thank God I'm free.
And yet this verse he's talking about is pretty clear, Michael. Colossians 3 verse 6 says, five says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what he means by that. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covet. Did you like the way I said that so well? Evil concupiscence. I got no idea what it means. And covetousness, which is idolatry. For which things' sake the wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience, in the which you also walked sometime when you lived in them, but now you also put off all these. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communications out of your mouth. Okay, but I'm not sure I understand, mate.
Well, first off, to get to Colossians chapter 3, you have had to read through Colossians chapter 1 and 2, which tells us the only way to mortify the deeds of the body or put to death the deeds of the body is the cross, that there is no other way. So we do have chapter 1 and chapter 2 that kind of gives us a precedent here. The other thing that's very important about this is that statement in Colossians 3:6 that the wrath of God cometh upon the children of disobedience. Now, let me tell you what it does not say, which is what goes through the mind when we read it, that the wrath of God comes on children who are disobedient. Now, first off, it does not say that the wrath of God comes on those who are disobedient. It comes on those who are the descendants of disobedience.
On the children of disobedience.
The children of disobedience. So disobedience is the constant. The product is its children. All right? So we know that teaching. It's Paul's teaching, the very same one who tells us that by one man's transgression, by one man's disobedience, all the children of that descendants from there are made sinners also. So we do understand what the children of disobedience means. This is a very important keystone when it comes to understanding just within the context of Colossians chapter 3, understanding who he is talking about and what the real problem is. The problem isn't the children. The problem was the disobedience. And these are the descendants of disobedience.
Bring your tithe and bring your shame. Bring your guilt and bring your pain. Don't you know that's not your name? You will always be much more to me. And every day I wrestle with the voices that keep telling me I'm not right. But that's alright, 'cause I hear a voice and it calls me every day. When others say I'll never be enough, and greater is the one living inside of me than he who is living in the world. In the world. In the world. And greater is the one living inside of me than he who is living in the world.
Gospel Revolution.
We are going into our series of the seven pillars of God's wisdom. And first off today, we're going to talk about what is wisdom first. If these are the pillars of wisdom, how did I come up with them? Why did I select these, number one? And I want to show you why I selected these as the seven pillars. Because I agree, as you pointed out, Barris, nobody's ever found where it says, okay, these are the seven pillars of wisdom.
My first one would be tithing. I mean, if I was a pastor, tithing would be right up there, number one. And after tithing might come, you know, feeding your pastor and buying him clothes and that, but, you know.
And I'm going to show you why that is not one of the seven pillars of wisdom.
So obviously you weren't pastoring when you come up with this.
Yeah, actually I was. That's why I said I didn't have sense enough to get up and dust myself off and walk away. Oh, goodness.
Now, here's another thing that is coming up a lot. It's a meme that keeps coming up. I've covered it with you before, but I want to keep covering it because I think it's really important. I see some of our family, some of the people who are good GRs, you know, they have fish on Friday and all that, and they seem to get caught up in this question, and I want to I loved what I saw Pat Martin Lockshaw say once. She said, I think I'm just about done trying to figure things out. I'm loved. I'm in love. I'm in God. That's all I need to know. I'm moving on.
That's a good place to be.
So here is this question about penal substitution. I saw someone, one of my buddies over in Fremantle, he's writing a book on it. And I see a lot of people reject it as well, that's the demands of a bloody and a bloody-minded God who wants to extract every last ounce of punishment and pain he can out of people who are sinners. If you mistake penal substitution, this is a theology which essentially says that Christ died to take the place of sinners in the wrath of God. That is an oversimplification to the point of almost calling the IRS a corner store.
Mm-hmm.
Misleading in the extreme. There were three things that Jesus Christ died for, and the two first things are by far and away the minor things, and the biggest thing for me is the last thing, which is that Jesus died so that he could end the Adamic race, make a new species, a new creation, a new world, a new heaven, a new earth, with himself as a prototype and us in his train, to use that old English word, coming along in his wake and included in him, in God. That was a big thing. The other two things that happened to occur at the cross was the removal of the imputation of sin on the whole human race and, secondly, dealing with Israel's shortcomings and the fact that they were the ones to whom was given the law and they were the ones who had earned themselves some detention marks as a result of it. But they're the three things, dealing with Israel's sin, dealing with the imputation of sin upon the whole world. But by far and away, if you miss the fact that Jesus Christ came to create a new species, I think the other whatever else you get just doesn't matter.
Well, I think the most important thing about the issue of the penalty of sin is that Jesus died to do away with sin and its penalty. That's all gone. Then for someone to come along behind and try to take that credit away from the cross, I don't understand that. But the and like you said, the broader issues, why did Jesus have to die? Because the old covenant had to die, because the law had to die, because the old heaven and the old earth had to pass away, because the priesthood had to be done away with, because the old glory had to be destroyed, the imputation of sin on the whole world. Jesus had to put an end to that generation, drawing an end to a race of people and drawing a final line that says this is the last Adam. I don't think we get the power of that. That was the last Adam, the last man to ever live of that creation. Oh my gosh, there are no more. And we are not connected to the race of Adam. We are connected to the race of the resurrected Christ, the resurrected Adam, if you will. And he did away with the human race. Goodness gracious, folks, why get so narrow-minded on a subject and miss the big picture altogether? The work of the cross is so huge for anyone to minimize this to a term that's not even in the Bible, penal substitution, and for us to come up with this whole reason just to throw the cross away. I don't get it. Jesus died to do away with everything that was against us between man and God. End of story.
Okay, well, I guess that's that.
The end of the story. And we'll answer the question again when it comes in again the next time, as we always do.
Well, all right then.
Bring your doubts, bring your fears, bring your hurt, bring your tears. There'll be no condemnation here. You are holy, righteous, and redeemed. Every time I fall, there'll be those who will call me a mistake. Well, that's okay, 'cause I hear a voice and he calls me redeemed. When others say I'll never be enough, and greater is the one living inside of me than he who is living in the world. In the world.
Wisdom.
Yeah. You want to talk a bit about wisdom?
Yeah, let's...
what it is.
Well, Barris, would you quote the verses about the seven pillars of wisdom for us, please?
Proverbs 9 verse 1 says, "Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out or dug out or carved out her seven pillars."
Yes. And this is where we get this from, subjects that I believe are the seven pillars of wisdom. I want to show you why first. Why would we say these are wisdom? Now, to be able to do that, we need to know what wisdom is. And then that way you'll be able to determine as we go through these seven pillars, is this truly wisdom? Is this truly the wisdom that the entire gospel is built upon? Is this what wisdom, are these pillars what wisdom would be telling us? And so to do that, we're going to go through Paul's teaching in 1 Corinthians. We could go through chapter 2 and chapter 3 all together, but we're going to try to limit this to chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians. And I think, Barris, we'll just start at chapter 1, verse 1. And I want you to understand that Paul's already spent one chapter talking about wisdom here. We could go back, but then we're going to wind up with at least two shows on wisdom and not get to the seven pillars. But you're going to find this very interesting. We're going to cover a part, if not all, of this chapter in 1 Corinthians chapter 2.
Okay, verse 1.
Verse 1. Read it for us.
And I, brothers, when I came to you, I did not come with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God.
Oh, well, let's stop right there. First off, he brings a clarification here as to what the story is all about. He said, I did not come to you with excellency of speech or any other kind of wisdom. I've come to you with the testimony of God. Now, all the years I was in Christianity, I heard a lot about testimonies. I know you did too, Barris. And a good testimony would get you a long way, a big offering. Goodness gracious, it could develop a whole ministry. My testimony developed an entire ministry. If I had not had a testimony, I would not have had a ministry. And that's the way it is with the entire Christian world.
Now, by testimony, just for those of you who may not have come from our neck of the woods, a testimony is once I was really, really bad, and then I met Jesus, and now I'm really, really good.
Yes, fill in the really, really bad and fill in the really, really good. That way, the gospel becomes so incredibly subjective.
Yeah, it's all about sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Exactly.
The more the better. And if there's a murder or two, well, that wouldn't hurt it.
Exactly. But this that Paul is speaking of, I never knew God had a testimony. Did you, Barris? Nobody ever told me that God had a testimony.
Once I was really, really bad.
I know.
I used to murder Israelis. And now I'm really, really good.
Exactly. Now I'm really, really good. And it kind of fits the gospel of peace, which is another thing that we could go into that people want to rewrite. But anyway, it says what it says, and it is what it is. But we do have a testimony of God. This is God's testimony. So wisdom, what do we find out about wisdom first off? Wisdom, and you can jot down a note here, wisdom is God's testimony, not mine. All right? You can repeat that with me.
Wisdom
is God's testimony, not mine.
So, right. So it is God saying, once I wiped the whole world out, except for about eight people, I sent a big old flood. Man, was I a bad God. Ooh-hoo, but now I was good.
Well, it's his testimony, regardless of what you might think it might be in his testimony. The number one thing is his wisdom, because it is his testimony. And when we ask questions, when we come up with answers, we need to rely on the wisdom of God. You see, most of the time when there are questions given to people who are in religious positions or positions of teacher or pastor or priest or elder or deacon or whatever it is, they respond with the wisdom of the world. Now, we've said for many, many times that questions are the lifeblood of the gospel revolution, but it is how we address these questions that draws out this lifeblood. It literally taps into, because the one place that we don't go is into our own testimony. when we are replying to a question about the gospel, I have to tell you God's testimony about it. So, number one, wisdom is God's testimony, not mine.
Well, what is the testimony of God?
Well, I think we should keep reading.
Okay. For I determined, I made my mind up not to know anything amongst you except Jesus Christ and him crucified.
Mm-hmm. That's the first good part about what God's testimony is.
That he doesn't know anything about us except Jesus Christ crucified?
Exactly. That is.
Then how's he going to know me?
He.
What's the point? You know, I go to a party and you introduce me to a guy and the guy says, I'm so pleased to meet you. I'm not going to know anything about you except through Michael and him crucified. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think that Paul's understanding of this was determining that on the level of works that he's choosing to do what God has done, and that's not to know us on a basis of works and performance, but on something much more important, and that's relationship.
Actually, that word in the Greek, to know, is an interesting word. It's the word from which we get I. And the Greek word is eido, and it means to see. So he says, I made my mind up not to see anything else amongst you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Very interesting.
Because that's what God sees. And thank you. That really did clarify that. I didn't even have to explain it.
Okay, so the first thing about the testimony of God is that
he sees us through the cross. That is God's testimony. He sees us through the work of the cross.
Michael, now verse 3. So the Mirror Bible reads, I felt completely inadequate. You know that it was not my eloquent speech that persuaded you. I was so nervous that my whole body was trembling with stage fright. My message was not with persuasive arguments based on secular wisdom, since my aim was not to point people to me, but rather to the powerful working of the Spirit in them. Wow. Now that changes. Boy, that changes the flavor of that verse.
Boy, it really does. Because, you know, and I wish I would have known this years ago. It would have saved me a whole lot of anguish about this very issue of that Paul had. He's talking about having panic attacks, according to the Mirror translation, which I think is probably the case here. And he says, even to the point of trembling. I remember telling you the story about that I've even refused to, back during some of the worst years of this, I refused to wear short sleeve shirts. And you said, well, why would you not want to wear short sleeve shirts? And I said, because they shake. It's like an earthquake. The earthquake quakes and then the building's big. It, you know, you can see it sway. But if I was standing there trembling, you could see my short sleeve shirt sleeves trembling. You know, you could see them wiggling around. So I wouldn't wear a short sleeve shirt when I got up to speak or anything. But here's the interesting thing about this, and we're talking, of course, about this wisdom, getting ready to go into the seven pillars of wisdom. And I think this is such a powerful point about Paul's teaching. Now, most people like to start out and say that Paul's teaching was with demonstration of the Spirit and of power. And as Francois brought out in his translation, is that he is there to reveal the power of the Spirit in the people. which I think that's wonderful. So most people read this and say that Paul was out teaching with the demonstration of the Spirit and power. So when he preached, he healed the sick, he raised the dead, he cleansed the lepers, he did all these miraculous things. But the odd thing is, one of the miracles that he needed more than anything was to end his panic attacks from being up on stage. So you can have panic attacks and still preach the gospel and demonstrate the power of it while you're having a panic attack. Now, folks, if that doesn't encourage you with some of your phobias, with some of your depressions, with some of your whatevers, let me tell you something. This gospel does not require one single degree of expectation upon the person who delivers the message. The expectation is upon the message itself. Now, that is a vast departure from Christianity, which has had to have some affirmation of the person to affirm the message. And Paul's saying Paul's saying diametrically opposite to that. And people who say that somebody came up with this, who in the world would come up with this to try to persuade somebody about the truth? It's not the standard way that people are persuaded to believe somebody. They've got to believe that they're strong and they're fearless and invincible. And when they talk, therefore, what they say is truth. Let me tell you something. That's Hitler. That is not a general representation of where you learn truth from. So don't be surprised at who you learn from. There's many people, just because Mike Williams is Mike Williams, they absolutely refuse to acknowledge that they learned anything from me even. Carry on ministries and all kinds of things. Absolutely with dreaded fear that someone is going to find out that they learned something from that Mike Williams, and we know all about him. Well, that shows that we really have no understanding of what the power of the gospel is. The power of the gospel is not here, and the wisdom of the gospel is not here to alter the person in any way. Oh my gosh, can I stand up on a mountaintop and shout that? The power of the gospel is not here to alter a person in any way, but in fact, quite the opposite, to affirm the person exactly where they are with no changes whatsoever. That is the demonstration of the power of the Spirit, that someone who is depressed, someone who is got panic attacks, someone who is an alcoholic, someone who it does not fit in our social norms whatsoever, that person can be a representation of the power of the Spirit.
I didn't come to you in lots of sophisticated man's knowledge, but I came to you in fear and trembling, and in the demonstration of the power of God in you, that your faith, I'm going back to the King Jimmy now, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men. Now, suddenly this verse makes a lot more sense. I didn't come and persuade you about my power, but of the power of God in you, so that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God, which is in you. Wow.
Exactly. So he's still not talking about their faith. He's talking about the power of God that is within them. And this is so very powerful, and this is the essence of wisdom. So we have this demonstration of wisdom and Paul's explanation of this wisdom. And remember, don't forget now, the very first thing, what is the very first thing you learn? What is wisdom? Wisdom is not your testimony.
God's testimony. Wisdom
is God's testimony. And you passed that test. Barris, you got that right.
I get to stay on another week.
So now, and then this comparison that Paul gives as to this, see, this collision of understanding of what the gospel is and the power of the Spirit or the power of God. What is this? It is what is revealed, not what is done. Please understand, the wisdom of the gospel is in what is revealed, not what is done by man. And what is revealed, that's what Paul, remember what Paul said in Romans? He said that, talked about the power of the gospel for the power of God, speaking about the power of God in the gospel because the gospel reveals the righteousness of God. So always remember, the power of God is not measured by what is done. The power of God is measured by what is revealed. Even in the midst of what's being done is counterintuitive to our moralistic or behavior orientation of the law. We can't seem to break that addiction to measuring righteousness, holiness, or acceptance or favor with God away from performance to it's a revelation. It is in its entirety a revelation.
Verse 6, however, we speak wisdom amongst those who are complete, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery hidden, which God ordained before the world for our glory.
Yes. When Paul says in verse 6, howbeit we speak wisdom among them that are perfect. Now, this is the very same thing that Paul said in his testimony in giving up his own righteousness. And in verse 15 of Philippians chapter 3, let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded. Paul was obsessed with this issue of perfection. But he wanted people to understand that perfection is a revelation, not an action. Oh, my goodness. If we could ever get this wisdom down for us.
Say that again. Wisdom was what?
Wisdom is a revelation, not a action or an achievement.
And, of course, this is just after Paul said, I was this, I was that, I was the other thing, I was this, all of that, plus a bag of chips. And guess what? Nothing. Didn't mean a thing.
Exactly. And see, he's drawing this very same comparison here by laying out the fact that he was with them in weakness and fear and trembling and panic attacks and all of this. But he's saying, you know, now this gospel does not, the power of this gospel does not lie in whether or not I'm having panic attacks or not. It lies in a revelation, not an action, not a performance, not a doing of any kind. Now, he's repeated that in his testimony in Philippians chapter 3, where he is assigning all that he ever did as dung. But he says, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. Now, this wisdom of God in the mystery, now we should be getting a clear picture here of what wisdom is. Wisdom is the difference between measuring righteousness by revelation rather than by performance. We ought to be getting that clue by now in Paul's teaching. In fact, I really encourage everybody to back up and read chapter 1 and go all the way through chapter 2. For this understanding of wisdom that Paul is getting here. Also, let me bring out the fact that he says, yet not the wisdom of this world. So what is the wisdom of this world? The wisdom of this world is referring back to performance-based doctrines for righteousness. The wisdom of this world is not the wisdom of, oh, well, you know, when you go to the bank, you have to make a deposit and you can only write checks on the account that you have. And this works this way and this works that way. He's not comparing the wisdom of the gospel to everyday wisdom. He's talking about the difference in the means by which we know we are righteous, the means by which we know we are perfect in the eyes of God, that it is no longer standing in the wisdom of men, which is based in works. It is in the power of God, which is based in a revelation, and a revelation only. Please remember that righteousness is in its entirety now a revelation.
Well, if everything God knew was written on your heart, you'd be pretty wise, wouldn't you?
That has to be wisdom, isn't it?
But isn't that what the prophets said, that in those days I will write my laws on their hearts?
Yes.
That sounds like a revelation to me.
It's a revelation. It's something you're born with. And that's the other thing. This isn't a revelation that you get later on. This is a revelation that from what I can understand, it is born in you intuitively. Now, the other part of this that I wanted to point out, he says, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor the princes of this world. Not of the princes of this world. Now, this is the same term where he talks about we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. This is the same Greek word, Barris.
Archon? Now, yes.
Yes. So he is reemphasizing here the doctrines of these places. Principalities and powers are not demons. They are people in positions of religion who are teaching works-based righteousness. That is a principality and a power. And Paul says that we have the ability to counteract that in its entirety. And to pull down, and he calls them strongholds, and that we have the ability to pull all that down. That's what we're doing in the gospel revolution. People say, well, why do you address Christianity the way you do? Because we are pulling down principalities and powers. We need you to know, you need to know that people do not have the right to teach doctrines that places you back under a bondage that Jesus set you free from. No one has a right to do that to you. We want you to have the ability to stand up and recognize the revelation by which you were made righteous and you were made holy.
I've just seen something which I never saw before, I think, which none of the princes of this world knew. Now, I was taught they were demons.
Yes.
For had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord. See, there you go. That's proof. The Satan was the one who got him strung up on that Roman gibbet, but it doesn't say he. It says they would not have crucified the Lord. Verse 8 of 1 Corinthians chapter 2, we're in family. Exactly. Had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Now, Satan is not a they. I don't care how much you want to make him a plural. He ain't plural. So this cannot possibly be speaking about Satan. And the reason I'm all kind of enervated right now is because I haven't seen this before, and it's been one of those areas that you've spoken about that I was kind of okay, I'll go along with that for now, but I'm not convinced. But here he says very clearly, they, the princes are they, the princes are not he, it, she,
exactly.
They're they. They're the same they that Jesus spoke about when he said, everyone who's come before me is a thief and a robber and they're all charlatans. He's talking about the religious leaders again. I had this conversation this morning with someone. No, that's a devil. No, it ain't.
Exactly. And the thief cometh not but for to steal, kill, and destroy. We assign that to the devil. And if you read the context, there is no mention of the devil in there. He is talking about preachers and teachers of the law, Pharisees, the people who were ascribing righteousness as a work. That is a principality and a power. Please remember, wisdom is that which reveals righteousness. It does not demand righteousness.
So first thing we know is that wisdom is the testimony of God. The second thing we know, unless I missed one in between, is that wisdom is a revelation.
Yes.
Okay.
And it is a revelation and not a requirement. That you just, this is the difference. Now, this is what Paul is telling us. Now, that's the reason he's bringing up about principalities and powers and, you know, that we're talking to those that are perfect. This makes perfect sense to those that are perfect. It makes perfect sense to those that are perfect. I love that. Paul said that in his testimony, and he's reaffirming it here. So going on down into this chapter, Beerus, what do we have?
But as it is written, eye has not seen. Now, whenever Paul says, as it is written, he's talking about an Old Testament scripture. But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them who love him. But God has revealed these things unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things. Yes, the deep things of God.
Not the deep things of man. Again, we're not looking through man's testimony. We're looking through God's testimony.
Say that again.
And we're looking through God's testimony. We're not looking through man's testimony. So what does the Spirit search? The Spirit is not searching out your little dirty secrets. The Spirit doesn't reveal negative things about you. How can the Spirit, who is, quote, the third person of God, in most traditional understanding, how could the Spirit reveal something contrary to what God says you look like and what you are? Not just look like, but what you are in Christ. 'Cause I hear a voice and he calls me redeemed. When others say I'll never be enough. That this was another shock in my life, because everybody got up and preached, oh, I have not seen nor ear heard, nor either has it entered into the heart of man the things. Folks, you don't know all the things God's got for you. The Bible says that right here in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, you don't know. It's not been revealed, the great things, but one of these days we'll know the things that's been given to us by God. You'll know this. You're going to know this. Let me tell you, this is a quote from Isaiah that was fulfilled at the cross. I hath seen, ear hath heard. It has entered into the heart of man the things that God hath prepared for them that love him.
Because what Paul is saying here was written 1,000 years earlier, when it was very true that I had not seen or ear had not heard. Nor had it ever entered into the heart of man.
And this is the turning point. This is the watershed moment in the history of the human race. And that is the former creation and the new creation, which is the work of the cross.
So where in the past I had not seen it, now since Calvary, God has revealed unto us these things by his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man save the spirit of a man which is in him? Even so, the things of God no man knows, but the Spirit of God does. Now, as opposed to then, now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know. Hello, there's a reason we've got this thing. That we might know the things which are freely given to us of God. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you ready for number three? What is wisdom? Now, first off, wisdom is God's testimony, not our testimony. The second thing we learned that wisdom is that it is a revelation of righteousness, not a demand for righteousness. And the third thing we learn about wisdom is it gives us knowledge of the things that come to us from God freely. There is no such thing as wisdom as to know what to do to get God to act. That is the wisdom of this world. That is the wisdom of the princes of this world. That is the wisdom of principalities and powers of this world. That is the power and the strength of an old covenant for an old creature. It is dead. It is gone. We have to get the GPS of this correct. We have to stop relating to God as an outward and a distant entity, to where that our GPS, our mental GPS, knows that God is no longer out there. He is in here. And in here is the revelation of this righteousness. This is God's testimony. God didn't get in you by your testimony. God got in you with his testimony. God didn't get in you by your works or your performance. He's there by revelation. Everything that you have is by revelation. Let me say this. If you've ever heard a preacher stand up and telling you that if you do this and you do that, God will do this or that, it is a lie. One of the interesting things in this whole issue about the fact that the Spirit is there to help us to know, have knowledge of the things that are freely given to us by God. The term freely is the very same term as the word grace. So these are the things that are graced to us. This is the things that come through grace. Wisdom does not tell you what comes through the law. That's the old way. Wisdom tells you what comes through grace. And that term grace happens to translate very well here as the term freely.
Verse 13, which things also we speak not in the words which man's wisdom teaches, but with words which the Holy Ghost teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man receives not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, neither can he know them because they are spiritually discerned.
Mm-hmm. Of course, here's one of those places where spiritual discernment is, again, put in that category of somebody reading your mail or knowing what's wrong with you. And what's wrong is what's wrong with the preacher who's doing it. That's what's wrong. And they turned all of this upside down on us. I did it as well as anybody else and was congratulated for doing it better than anybody else. But this comparison of spiritual things to spiritual things. And if you noticed, preachers will always compare natural things to spiritual things to distort the spirit. Now, it's the very same thing that they do when they try to misrepresent chastisement. And by not carrying out the thought fully, they say, well, you know, our Father will chastise us. So what makes you think that God's not chastising us too? But see, if you read Hebrews in its entirety, it takes that thought out completely. And it says that they chastised us for a time, for a period of time. Why did we miss that part? So if we're going to carry out that, then let's read it all the way through and let's get the full impact of that.
Can you give us another example of how preachers will often compare natural with spiritual in an effort to make a spiritual point?
Anything that's based in works or performance, that if you put effort into this, this is what you're going to get out of it. You know, if you put in a long day's work, you get pay. Well, that's comparing a natural thing to a spiritual thing. Putting in a day's work and getting a day's pay, believe me, there's wisdom in that.
And yet that's very natural wisdom. That's wisdom that appeals to us. And yet Jesus taught a parable in which the people who arrived at the end of the day got the same amount of money as the ones that arrived at the beginning of the day.
Exactly. Very good point.
Different kind of wisdom, I guess.
Different kind of wisdom. Any teaching that tells you what you have to do to get something, that's a natural teaching. Doesn't mean it's not a good teaching. Doesn't mean it's not applicable for this life. It's good stuff. When the grass grows, you got to mow the lawn. If you mow the lawn, you're going to have a nice yard. If you pick up the clippings after, you're going to have an extra nice yard. But when preachers get up and start talking about keeping a short list with God, that was one of the natural things, you know, is that they gave. Well, you got to keep a short list with God, you know, keep those sins confessed up, you know. And, well, that's comparing a natural thing to a spiritual thing. Why? Because there is no list with God anymore. You don't have a clean slate. The slate has been taken away. Christianity teaches that the slate's clean, and now you got to keep that slate clean. And if you get another mark on your slate, you got to confess your sins and get it right with God. Throw away the slate. There are no such things in the kingdom of God.
For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ.
Yes, we do have the mind of Christ. And he says in verse 15, but he that is spiritual judgeth all things. Now, wait a minute. I thought the number one thing that we were to be freed from was judgment. Now he says, if you're spiritual, if you have wisdom, you will judge all things. What all things? Did he say all people? No, things aren't people, number one. And what are the things that you have the ability to judge because you now have the mind of Christ? You're able to judge every teaching you hear. With the three principles that are laid out in this chapter, you now can judge everything you hear, whether or not it is the wisdom of God or the wisdom of man. Which one is it? People all the time call and say, well, so-and-so said this, and I read this verse, and it seems to disagree with that one over there, and it's just such frustration. But see, at some point, you stop hearing the wisdom of the world at all. Once you understand what wisdom does, now you're going to see why I selected these seven doctrines as pillars of wisdom. You're going to see why based on Paul's definition of what wisdom is. So of these seven pillars that we're going to be talking about, this is the foundation that I drew from to determine what a pillar of wisdom could or would be. So let's go down through this again. So what are the four topics of what wisdom is? Wisdom is, number one, God's testimony. Number two, wisdom reveals righteousness. It does not demand it. That's number two. Number three, wisdom can only tell you what comes from God freely. Wisdom can never tell you what to do to get something from God. Based on these three things, the last thing that wisdom does is gives you the ability to judge every teaching you ever hear as to whether or not it is the truth. You're going to know whether it's coming from a principality or power or a thought that has been established, a stronghold in your mind that says these things are based on performance. And you're going to know. You don't have to be taught by everybody as to what the truth is. But while you may hear something from a lot of different people, you now have the ability to know whether or not what you're hearing is truth or fiction. There is no reason for anyone to ever be duped by false doctrine ever again, as long as you know what wisdom is and what it teaches us. Pillar number one, the doctrine of redemption. Pillar number two, the doctrine of sin and forgiveness. Pillar number three is scripture. Pillar number four is the doctrine of death and resurrection. Pillar number five is the doctrine of predestination. Pillar number six is the doctrine of freedom. Pillar number seven is the doctrine of fulfillment. And next week, we will begin to build on these seven pillars, these doctrines. Those of you who know what these doctrines are, can you already see that we use the scope of 1 Corinthians chapter 3 to determine what these things are? I promise you, we're not going to get outside the scope of 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I know you were trying to stop me that I was saying chapter 3, but hey, I just thought you wanted to interrupt me again.
I know. It's pretty funny here in the studio sometimes, family.
We have a good time.
And so it is that we must leave you, family. We appreciate you one and all, and we especially thank all of you who, with your financial support, keep this message of grace and peace going out every week. If you'd like to join them in increasing our coverage of the gospel, call our office at area code 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey. Remember that ending, in fact, at the end of September, a 300-page book, a $30 book entitled Redemption, A Declaration for All, Not a Choice for a Few, and authored by Mr. Robert Hines, is free in electronic format to everybody
and hot dog
who makes a donation of any size to the Gospel Revolution. So call our office now at area code 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey. If you'd like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone us at area code 234-564-0971 and leave a message for me. Michael, I found a disaster this morning. Bola was trying to leave a message, and for some reason our voicemail's been switched out. It's up and working again now. I'm sorry to anyone who's called in. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and we are always up for a Facebook chat at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, all the gospel all the time is being broadcast 24/7 at my radio stream. myradiostream.com/gospelrevolution. And so it's good night from myself, Beres Bartlett, from the simple Gospel Revolution Studios here in Nashville, Tennessee. And
it's good night from Michael Williams right here in beautiful Houston, Texas. Thank you guys so much. Please let me remind you to remember Moses and his family. If you would like to help them out, please just contact the office. Moses is at this hour being held hostage in the hospital for lack of funds to be able to exit. I know that sounds really bizarre to our Western minds, but that's just the way it is. They will hold him and continue to allow the bill to increase until he pays. You have to pay your way out of the hospital there. And they need about $5,000. So if you'd like to help, thank you. In fact, it's probably closer to $6,000. Thank you guys so much. We love you. We love you to pieces and love every bit of those pieces. So thank you so very much. We will stop laughing at me, Bears. Here I try to be creative and I just get mocked. I get openly mocked.
We love every piece of you. I don't even want to go there.
Oh, yes, you do, but you're not. Thanks, guys. We love you so much. And please join us next week on the Beres Abuses Mike program, and we would love to have you back again. Thank you.
So for more abuse of Michael Williams, please tune in again same time next week, same channel, where we're going to do the same thing all over again.
I'll be abused even better next time.
Really? I love all those pieces. Oh, golly. I'm sorry, buddy. That might be your best yet.
It may be.
All right, fella. Thanks so much. My God, I don't believe it. We got through to the end of this one.
We did.
We're going to have a look at your machine. All right, bud. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye, friend.
What if everyone we meet is going to heaven? What if all it took was one to bear the cost? What if every single sin, just as if they'd never been, were forgiven and forgotten at the cross? Are we looking in the right place for the answers? What if Sunday morning preachers got it wrong? What if all we need is good news, not building funds and church pews, and the Son of God's been tearing our walls down? One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God above and Father of all. One hope in a life that was given, a new life arisen, one Spirit inside of us all. The deaf can hear and the lame can walk, and the blind are made to see. Holding true to His design, that's all been happening to me. In a letter to believers in Galatia, who cast a spell and made you act the fools, you started in the Spirit and you knew that you could hear it. Now the only thing you're following is rules. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God above and Father of all. One hope in a life that was given, a new life arisen, one Spirit inside of us all. Jesus died and lives for us, reaching aside where He's hidden us, and believe it's not about the things that we do. The law and sin's been crucified, we'll listen as His loving bride. Salvation is to realize that it's true. There's nothing more to do.
Gospel Revolution.